Welcome to the Deep Dive. You know, we all face that mountain of information, especially in law. Case files, briefs, articles. It's a lot.
It really is.
So that's what we do here. We take a specific topic, dig through the sources, and pull out the key stuff so you can get up to speed efficiently. Think of it as your focus briefing.
And today, we're diving into a case that's particularly relevant if you're navigating law school right now, Logan VDW Sivers Co.
Right. We've looked at the podcast guidance, a detailed case brief, and a more standard brief to get a rounded view.
The core issue, it really gets into the weeds of preliminary agreements. What happens when something like a letter of intent, which often says it's non-binding, is breached? Especially, you know, when there are big tax consequences hanging in the balance, like in this real estate deal.
Exactly. It highlights this inherent tension, doesn't it? You've got an LOI that says, hey, this isn't the final deal, but then it has specific clauses inside it. Like, are those parts enforceable?
That's the $1 million question, or in this case, the $900,000 question, roughly. And the fact that the Oregon Supreme Court was actually split on the outcome just tells you how tricky this area is.
Okay, so let's set the scene. Who were the players?
Well, on one side, you have Lillian Logan. She's the seller of a property. Just sold it for about $3.9 million.
Okay.
And her plan was crucial. She wanted to do a 1031 exchange. Now, for anyone maybe not deep into tax or real estate law yet, a 1031 exchange is basically a mechanism in the tax code. It lets you sell an investment property and defer paying capital gains taxes on the profit if you reinvest those proceeds into a similar or like-kind property within a specific time frame.
Right, so it's a timing thing. You need to find that replacement property fairly quickly.
Precisely. And Logan identified a shopping mall owned by the other party, DW Sivers Company, as her target replacement property. The price tag was around $5.28 million.
So they started talking, and they signed a letter of intent, an LOI.
Yes. And this is absolutely critical. The LOI itself explicitly stated it was non-binding concerning the actual purchase and sale of the shopping mall.
But there's always a but in these cases, isn't there?
Always. Inside this non-binding LOI was a very specific, and what turned out to be very important, clause, a 60-day no-shop provision.
Okay, what did that mean?
It meant DW Sivers Co. promised they wouldn't solicit, encourage, or even negotiate any other offers for that shopping mall for a 60-day period. It gave Logan an exclusive window, basically.
An exclusive window to try and finalize the deal for her 1031 exchange.
Exactly. But that promise didn't last the full 60 days.
Uh-huh. What happened?
Well, only 21 days into that 60-day period, Sivers Co. turned around and sold the shopping mall to a completely different buyer.
Wow. So less than halfway through the agreed-upon no-shop period.
Correct. A clear breach of that specific clause.
And for Logan, this was disastrous, right? Because her 1031 exchange plan just went up in smoke.
Completely. With the Sivers property off the table, she couldn't find a suitable replacement property in time to meet the strict deadlines for the 1031 exchange.
So instead of deferring taxes, she got hit with a huge tax bill.
A very significant one. The damages she claimed were $919,652, representing the capital gains taxes she now had to pay because the Sivers deal fell through, preventing the 1031 exchange.
So naturally, she sued Sivers Company, arguing that breaking the no-shop directly caused this massive financial loss.
Yeah, it was her claim. Which brings us squarely to the two big legal questions the courts had to grapple with.
Okay, let's break those down.
First, was that no-shop clause actually enforceable? I mean, could it be legally binding even though it was sitting inside an LOI that explicitly said the main deal wasn't binding yet?
And second.
Second, if the no-shop was enforceable and Sivers breached it, what kind of damages could Logan recover? Could she get those tax losses, the nearly $920,000, which are what we call expectation damages, or was she limited to just reliance damages?
Okay, explain those damage types quickly in this context.
Sure. Expectation damages aim to put the injured party, Logan, here in the financial position she would have been in if the contract or the specific promise hadn't been broken. So for her, that means as if the 1031 exchange had happened, meaning no immediate tax liability.
Got it. And reliance damages.
Reliance damages are different. They cover the expenses the injured party incurred in reliance on the promise being kept, sort of preparing for the deal. Think things like maybe due diligence costs, legal fees for drafting initial documents, appraisal costs, money spent getting ready for a deal that didn't happen because the promise was broken. It doesn't aim to give them the benefit of the bargain itself.
Right. A much smaller amount, typically. So the court had to decide enforceable promise.
Mm.
And if so, expectation or just reliance damages.
Exactly. And the Oregon Supreme Court's answer was Well, split.
Let's start with the majority opinion, written by Justice Gillette. What do they say about the no-shop clause?
The majority actually agreed with Logan on the first point. They said, yes, the no-shop clause was an enforceable promise.
Even within the non-binding LOI?
Yes. Their reasoning was that parties can make specific, definite promises that they intend to be binding, even if the overall framework agreement isn't finalized yet. They saw the no-shop as exactly that, a clear, standalone promise meant to be kept.
Okay, so Sivers breached an enforceable promise. That seems straightforward. But then came the damages issue.
And that's where the majority drew the line. They held that Logan could only recover reliance damages, not the expectation damages, the tax losses.
Why? If Sivers broke a binding promise that led to the loss.
Their rationale was tied directly back to the explicit non-binding nature of the LOI regarding the sale itself. Because there was never a finalized binding contract for the sale of the property, the majority felt Logan couldn't claim damages based on the expected outcome of that sale, namely the tax savings.
So they're saying because you hadn't actually locked in the purchase contract, you hadn't legally secured the right to those tax benefits yet.
Essentially, yes. They emphasized that by signing an LOI that was non-binding as to the sale, the parties consciously chose not to assume the full risks and benefits of a completed transaction at that preliminary stage. The risk of the deal falling through and the associated consequences like tax implications hadn't been fully shifted via a binding sale contract.
Okay. I can see the logic there, focusing strictly on the overall nature of the LOI.
Yeah.
But you mentioned a dissent.
Yes. Justice Kistler wrote a dissent, and he saw things quite differently, particularly on the damages.
Did he agree the no-shop was enforceable?
Oh, yes. No argument there. Both majority and dissent agreed Sivers made a binding promise and broke it. The fight was all about the consequences.
So what was Justice Kistler's take on the damages?
He strongly argued that Logan should be able to recover the $919,652 in tax losses, the expectation damages.
And his reasoning.
Foreseeability. He argued that the whole point of the no-shop clause was precisely to protect Logan's ability to complete the 1031 exchange. Sivers knew, or should have known, that breaching it would likely torpedo the exchange and cause exactly this kind of tax damage.
So he's saying the loss wasn't some remote, unexpected consequence.
Exactly. He viewed it as a direct and foreseeable result of Sivers' breach. If Sivers hadn't breached, he reasoned, it was highly probable the deal would have closed, Logan would have completed her 1031, and the tax loss would have been avoided.
Did he address the non-binding nature of the LOI?
He did, essentially saying that while the sale wasn't guaranteed, the promise not to shop was, and breaking that specific promise had foreseeable consequences. He also pointed out, crucially, that the LOI didn't contain any language specifically disclaiming liability for this type of expectation damage arising from a breach of the no-shop.
So his focus was more on fairness and holding the breaching party responsible for the predictable fallout of their actions.
You could say that. It was about the foreseeable consequences stemming directly from the breach of the specific binding part of the agreement, even if the larger deal wasn't yet set in stone.
It really highlights different judicial philosophies on how to interpret these preliminary agreements, doesn't it? Strict interpretation versus looking at the practical purpose and foreseeable results.
Absolutely. And it brings several key legal concepts into play that are vital for law students. We've mentioned the 1031 exchange. Understanding how critical that tax deferral strategy was for Logan is key to seeing the stakes.
Right. And the whole idea that an LOI can be a hybrid, generally non-binding, but with specific binding clauses like the no-shop, that's a major takeaway.
Definitely. You can't just look at the label non-binding on the cover sheet and assume nothing inside matters legally. Specific promises can still bite.
And then the distinction between reliance and expectation damages. This case is almost a textbook example of that fight.
It really is. Reliance damages look backward. What did you spend getting ready? Expectation damages look forward. Where would you be if the promise was kept? The majority kept Logan looking backward. The dissent wanted to put her where she expected to be.
And foreseeability. The linchpin of the dissent. Was the tax loss a predictable outcome of breaking the no-shop? The dissent screamed yes. The majority implicitly said not sufficiently connected given the lack of a final sale agreement.
Which leads us to the practical lessons, particularly for anyone who might draft or advise on these kinds of agreements.
What's the big takeaway for drafting LOIs after seeing this case?
Clarity, clarity, clarity. If you have a specific clause in an LOI, like a no-shop, an exclusivity period, a confidentiality clause, and you intend for a breach of that specific clause to potentially trigger damages related to the main transaction, like lost profits or, here, lost tax savings, you probably need to spell that out.
So you might need language explicitly saying, breach of this no-shop clause may result in liability for damages including, but not limited to, losses incurred due to the failure to complete the anticipated transaction.
Something along those lines, yes. The Logan majority suggests that without such explicit linkage, courts might default to limiting damages to reliance costs, especially if the overall LOI disclaims binding effect on the main deal. You need to make the intended consequence of breaching that specific clause unambiguous.
That has huge implications for deal strategy, especially in real estate or M&A, where these preliminary agreements are common and deals can be very sensitive. Like with 1031s.
Absolutely. You need to be very intentional about what promises are truly binding and what the agreed upon consequences are if they're broken. Don't leave it ambiguous.
It's also worth remembering, didn't the initial jury actually side with Logan on the damages?
Yes, that's an important point from the case background. The trial court jury did award Logan the full $919,652 in tax losses.
What evidence might have swayed them and also influenced the dissenting justice?
Well, the case brief mentions a few things. Apparently, Sievers didn't object to Logan's proposed timeline for drafting the final purchase and sale agreement, suggesting things were moving forward. There is also evidence hinting Sievers themselves had their own 1031 exchange motivations, implying they genuinely intended to sell to Logan initially.
Ah, so that suggests the deal closing was quite likely if the breach hadn't happened.
That was certainly the argument. Plus, the LOI itself reportedly had a fair amount of detail on the essential terms, making it seem less like a vague agreement to agree and more like a concrete step towards a final deal, but for the breach.
And how does the standard sort of textbook legal brief summarize the outcome?
It typically boils it down to the core rule from the majority. Yes, a non-solicitation or no-shop promise can be binding on its own, but if it's within an overall non-binding LOI for the main deal, damages for its breach might be capped at reliance damages.
The takeaway being, careful what you promise, but also be aware that even if you win on breach, your recovery might be limited if you didn't have a final binding deal for the main transaction.
Precisely. It reinforces that limitation based on the preliminary nature of the agreement.
So wrapping this up, Logan VDW Sievers Comp really throws a spotlight on this fundamental tension, doesn't it? The enforceability of specific promises made early in negotiations versus the general understanding that you're not fully committed until the final contract is signed.
It really does. It shows that even those seemingly less formal steps, like an LOI, can have very real teeth and serious legal and financial consequences if not handled carefully.
Which leaves us with a question to chew on, maybe. In these preliminary stages, how should the law strike the balance? How do we protect parties who rely on specific promises, like Logan relied on the no-shop, without prematurely locking parties into deals they haven't fully agreed to yet?
That's the million-dollar policy question, isn't it? How do you foster good faith negotiation and protect reliance on specific commitments while still preserving the freedom to negotiate the main deal or even walk away before signing on the dotted line? There's no easy answer.
But understanding cases like Logan is crucial for anyone entering transactional law. It shows just how much rides on the exact words used, even in documents that are supposedly non-binding.
Absolutely. It's a masterclass in the importance of precise drafting and understanding the interplay between different contract principles, binding versus non-binding terms, reliance versus expectation damages, foreseeability, a really valuable deep dive for any law student.
Definitely food for thought. We encourage everyone to keep exploring these contract law nuances. Thanks for tuning in to The Deep Dive.